Yeah, yeah, so please, in a few minutes we'll start questions again. Okay, so we can answer. Still doing that work with your phonetics course. He's added a few more, David, and doing his work on it and researching other things. He's because there he uses, I think, 70 phonemes. He's found another 7 that actually in the work itself, you find them in the spelling, they'll describe them. Yeah, yeah. They describe them, but it seems that maybe this was brought up after they've already fixed on 70 phonemes. Because they mention in their comments, means the writers of the text. And they refer to that these come up and they're pronounced in this way and they have these certain things. So I think they apply spelling rules on them. But they don't, so he found that it was easier to do that. And then we did an interesting thing because the sight words don't follow any of the rules. So I told him to when you print out the phoneme cards, to also print out all the sight words. So they just learn them by rote, just like that. You know, you just tell them this is how it's pronounced. So then, because I noticed that when we taught it to the, we had some girls, 7-year-olds, that were one of those dyslexic, so they were 7 and reading. They were very smart. And then in the 3 weeks they had learned all the phonemes. You could hand them this and they could read all the big words and everything, but all the sight words they got stuck on. You know, that one syllable words was throw them off. But they 5 syllable words, yeah, was always. These ones threw them off, but they could 5 syllable words, no problem. You know? So then I thought, well, if they've already memorized them, then there'll be absolutely no. And he dug them out. It's a fairly big size list. But I forget what it was. Well, some of them we've done something to them with. If you use English pronunciations of them, they have some rules with those like silent E's and some other funny things you can kind of get by. But sometimes they don't. You don't know which one it is. But it's interesting. It's combining that with, I think, some other things and exercises. We worked on the spelling rules a bit. Kind of rearranged them because a lot of them are subdivisions of another one. So we put it so it looks like that. So, you know, because it's always the less the numbers, the easier it sounds. You know, there's 30 rules, but you put it together, there's only 20 and 10 of them in seconds. So there's 20 rules in each subdivision. So it's more easily acceptable to the mind than it would say, yeah, there's 30 rules. So, you know, some work like that is going on. David, he's working on because he's even England. He was teaching these. He got trained in his school for teaching. But it was specific. I mean, it wasn't anybody. It was like that. It wasn't like a regular school. It was specific just to come to English. He didn't know English. So they had this special course. He was already familiar with that kind of concept. So it worked. It worked better.
The phonics is really good.
It's good. Yeah. But if it works for them, or kids that aren't dyslexic, it works even better. We found a smart kid in 3 weeks in Rio. You know, except for that problem with the sight loss. But if we do that, then it'll probably take 4 weeks to memorize all that, and then 4 weeks in they don't know reading. that's a minor detail, but they're reading.
Then they got to learn to read. They then have to read to them. They need to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe what we should do is after a month when they can read, we should send them home for like a medical treatise or something, you know, to read out loud, you know, so like that. I don't know if their mother can hear the next reading stuff. They can't even read. Right?
They might get stuck with that.
No, it's true. I'm just saying something. Like that. Yeah, yeah, something ridiculous. We have one, then we'll go. So one question is, what about using the Mahabharata in preaching? It can be used very nicely. The just main thing is if you are connecting it to Krishna, because it may or may not be so directly done in the Mahabharata itself, like that. Whose question is this? They're gone. Okay. So, answer your question.
Just wondering about the mechanics of winding it up and purification. What's the difference?
Difference between winding it up and purification.
In terms of the mechanical process.
Means as two separate things, or? Means you're winding it up, means basically as one purifies oneself, one is able to give up, loosen the attachments, then one is able to wind it up. Because otherwise the tendency will be, it'll be difficult to wind it up because of attachments. You know? It's just like if you want to clean out your cupboard or closet, the only thing stopping you is attachments. Because you haven't been in that closet for years, and you've lived very comfortably without anything in that closet for years. So technically you could, without even blinking, you could just pick up everything in the closet and get rid of it. But due to attachment, that won't happen. Because as soon as you're pulling it out, everything in the closet at some point was valuable to you, that's why it's in the closet. So then that value will again arise in the heart, and one won't be able to throw it away. Right? Does that make sense? So that is why the process of naishkarmya is used, because it comes down to this. This is the natural thing. If it's valuable, I'll keep it. If it's not valuable, I'll throw it away. Right? But everything in the closet, basically, it's valuable. So I can't throw anything away. So, because we're looking at it from sakam, that if it's good for me, I do it. If it's not good for me, I don't do it. Right? So if you prove to me that family life is disgusting and material life and pursuit of economics and all that, then I won't do it. Right? But if somehow or another, I run into problems from not dealing with that, or I see somebody dealing with it and it seems to be fine, then the problem will come up again. Right? Because it's the sakam aspect. The nishkam means that you're going to take it and you're going to acknowledge its value, but it's not for you. Right? In other words, if you want to clean out that closet, you pull everything out of the closet one by one and you decide what is valuable and what is not. Right? You know what I'm saying? What's not, you throw away. But what's valuable, you're not deciding that it's mine, you're just deciding it's valuable. So it would be put on the side. So still there's no problem. The problem comes when, okay, this pile of valuable is mine. Right? But it's valuable, but I don't need it. Right? So then that's given away. Understand? So, it's valuable means it has some meaning because it's Krishna's energy. And Krishna's process, Krishna's Varnashram, Krishna's economics, Krishna's everything. And I have attachment for it. So, you know, so I acknowledge the value is there, but the result of it's not for me. So one is able to deal with it and at the same time give it up. Right? It's a very simple thing. This works both for clearing the heart and clearing the closet. But if you check, generally we're not so good at clearing out the closet. Right? You know what I'm saying? It's very emotionally disturbing to somebody to go in and clear out the closet for them. Right? Even though they've asked you to do it. Right? So in here is what we see is that generally is we don't deal with something material because of its how terrible it is or bad it is. Right? That's our inspiration for not being materially absorbed. Rather than there's not really much of a problem with it, but it's of no interest to us because we have a different purpose. You know what I'm saying? If that's understood, then your social functionings start to work more smoothly. Right? Because if there's too much attachment or too much detachment, you cannot actually work with something properly. You know what I'm saying? It just doesn't work. Because the attachment then you become, or detachment becomes centered on yourself. But it's a relationship, so that means the other person is considered. Does that make sense? No. Means considering other people in a relationship doesn't make sense, or what I said didn't make sense? The wording, okay. Just having some fun. If I'm self-centered, how much sensitivity can I put into another person? Right? So attachment and aversion are self-centeredness. Because it's my attachment. I'm not looking at the other person's attachment. I'm looking at my attachment. Right? Or my attachment to their attachment. I'm attached to them, so they're attached to that, therefore I'm interested in it. But I'm not interested in it because they're attached to it. I'm interested because I'm attached to them. Does that make sense? The child likes sweets. It's not that the mother likes sweets, that's why she's interested to give the child sweets. Right? And it's not that so much that the child's interested in sweets that she's interested in giving him sweets. She's interested in giving him sweets because he's attached to them and she's attached to the kid. So if she gives sweets to the kid, then that attachment she has to the kid can be, developed. But if she's in a bad mood, does the child get sweets? No, but the child wants sweets, but it doesn't get. Why? Because the connection with the kid is the mood's different. You understand? So that's why our view is like that. So if the attachment or the repulsion is too great, one cannot actually, in a natural way, deal with any object. Right? If you get, let's say there's something you've desired for a long time, something very valuable, and you finally get it. Let's say like an article of clothing. Can you comfortably just wear it like you wear all your other clothing? No, you can't sit anywhere, you can't go anywhere, anything made this, that, all you're doing is absorbed in the cloth. Does that make sense? So, until that is adjusted, then only you can behave normally. Does that make sense? So, this is a very understood aspect of the non-Vedic so-called cultures. I would say culturally, it's their biggest stumbling block in practically applying any culture, is because of this not being able to appreciate the ability to work with something based on duty, or based on that is for the other person's pleasure, and because this is the way Shastra says it is. Right? So, does that make sense? Because then one may say, question, well, why? Because then we see we've given the thing where, because I'm attached to the kid, therefore the kid's needs then become important to me. But if I'm not so attached to the kid, then those needs aren't, I don't endeavor to fulfill. Does that make sense? So, this is because it's simply subjective to my, you know, this, to myself. But if we look at it from the element that there's a duty, that this is what that nature likes and does not like, so my duty is to fulfill that. My inspiration to do that may be my attachment. But whether I'm feeling positive or negative attachment, it doesn't affect my duty. Does that make sense? I'm in a good mood, I'm in a bad mood, still the duties that are expected of me are performed. Because the duties are being done because that's what that's how the relationships are supposed to function. Right? You're in a relationship because you gain something from someone else, right? You're not in a relationship because you don't gain anything, right? Does that make sense? So that gain means there's something expected from them and there's something expected from you. So if those are performed, the relationship works perfectly. Right? So this concept of this fear of detachment and fear of duty are probably the biggest thing that gets in the way of many or most of the from the non-Vedic cultures, who themselves are not rooted in the old school of duty and all this and all those kind of qualities. Then it's a little easier for them. You know, you'll see they'll be more cultured. But this other is that there's it's not known what is the duty, and this word detachment. It's a nasty word in the Western vocabulary. But the attachment only adds the mood to it. The mechanics of it functions. Let us say, one could then say, but yes, it's the mood of it that's important, not the mechanics, otherwise it's dry. But let us take the example, and let's say you're talking on the phone to somebody. You know, a very close associate. Something goes wrong in the conversation. The other person gets angry. The other person hangs up the phone. You call back, they don't answer. Now, are you happy with that because, well, at least the emotion has been expressed? Or would you be happier if they would pick up the phone even though it was just mechanical and told you actually what was wrong? Which of the two? Yeah, so that's the point, is that if the form is not there, what is the mood going to manifest through anyway? Right? If we say the mood's important, yes, it is the most important of the two, of the mechanics, of the form, and of the mood. So the mood's the most important. But if there's no form, what is the mood going to manifest through? Right? What? So it has to manifest through a form. Does that make sense? So if the form's not in place, where's the question of the mood ever manifesting? And if the mood manifests, but you don't know what the form is, then what happens? How many times you've been with good friends and everything's going nicely, and they've meant to make a joke, but somehow or another, their joke made you upset. So the mood was right, but the form was wrong. Right? Now, let us say somebody's doing all the right things, but the mood's not there. So it's kind of like, okay, that's nice, now let's get a little feeling. Right? It's not like, oh, it's just mechanics. No. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Right? The girl has looked in the mirror. And it looks nice. But she wants the other person to say it's nice. And so they'll go, yeah, it's nice. So they said it's nice. No, we want some feeling in that saying it's nice. But they're saying it's nice because you've asked them to say it's nice. So they're not quite sure. But it'll go on until they say, yeah, no, that's really great. No, no, you don't think it because you didn't say it with feeling. You said the form without feeling. Therefore, it wasn't. No, no, it is. And you have to go on and on and on until you're finally convinced that it's nice. And then, oh. Right? But that mood must come through the form. Yes or no? So that's the point, is that then when Prabhupada has given us this whole Varnashram and whole Vaishnava etiquette, that's the form through which devotees can interact with each other on all levels. You know, emotional, intellectual, devotional, economic, sensual, religious, you know, how you say, transcendence, anything. It's complete. But we don't want to touch it because we're afraid we're going to lose some of that, how you say, harsh, coarse, painful, malecha experiences why we came to Krishna consciousness in the first place. We couldn't stand it anymore. But we're so attached to them because of the impersonalism, we don't know that there is actually an alternative. Without that faith, we don't want to give it up because, you know, what is it? Blind uncle is better than no uncle. So a bad experience is better than no experience at all, right? You know, the person hates you, but at least there's interaction. You know, it's better than nothing, right? So in the same way, then the problem comes is that we don't want to accept that if I follow all these, then everything works, because then relationships function. And if relationships function, then you have something to express your feelings through. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Is that answer? Something else? That's it.
Last Sunday you mentioned that when a person falls asleep, he merges back into the body of the Lord.
Yes.
And one very often that we always think about sleep as a motivator.
Yeah, it is motivator. Just because you've merged back into the Lord when you're asleep doesn't mean that you're not in ignorance. Just like this. You fell asleep on your bed, right, with your blankets and your pillow. So, is the position of a bed, a blanket, a pillow, and a person the mode of ignorance? No. And just because they happen to be laying down and all, you know, put together in a particular order, you know, bed, person, then blankets, then is that the mode of ignorance? No. So what's the mode of ignorance? Means the consciousness. So it doesn't matter where you're situated. The point is the consciousness, if you're in ignorance, you're in ignorance. It doesn't matter where you're situated. Does that make sense? The point is that's why for the Lord it's called Yoga Nidra, because he's asleep, but he's not in ignorance. Right?
That's fine. So would that suggest that the spirit souls merged in Brahma Jyoti are not asleep, they're awake?
Yeah. The ones in Brahma Jyoti are awake, they're thinking, I am Brahman. And when they get tired of going, I am Brahman, then they come back to the material world. Right? The point is what it is on here is what you have to, I mean, is there, that point is there, but the important thing to catch in these technical aspects of the metaphysics is what's connected to the Lord, because everything else is not important, right? We're not shaktas that we get down to all the technical little breakdowns of everything, you know? Like the Brahma Gayatri for the Shaktas is broken down, it has 24 syllables. Each syllable represents one of the 24 elements of material energy. We don't bother with that. So, what's important for us here is that we're in touch with the Lord, and that's what's actually enlightening to the soul. The soul actually gets enlightened that it again can open its eyes and face the world again, even though when it went to sleep it may not have been in that state of mind. So from that one can understand, therefore, if when I'm conscious I try to connect myself to the Lord, then how nice that's going to be, how enlightened I will be. There I was unconscious, and by being in contact with the Lord I became inspired, let alone if I'm conscious. That's what we glean. Because otherwise, intellectually, we could go on everything. You know, why is that window over there square? And is that proportion actually the best proportion? But, you know, the handle's on this side of the door, but what about putting it on the other side of the door? You know, and that's got 3 hinges, but maybe if you use 4. You know, I'm just saying, you know, it's like, depending on what it is, if I'm looking at aesthetics, I look at it one way. If I'm looking at engineering, I'll look at it another way. You know what I'm saying? I'm looking at economics, I'll look at it another way. Right? Windows are expensive, I could have no windows. Right? But then there's a question of health. You need some light and air. Okay, so then we put one of those in. You know. But then, you know, then the economics, how many can I put? You know what I'm saying? So depending on what it is, so for us the Krishna consciousness. So unless one can explain one's purpose, then one has to be careful of going off on tangents, on the technicalities of the metaphysics of the Vedic literature. They're there because somebody is interested in them. But it doesn't mean that who's interested in them is interested in God. Does that make sense? So always when the process of mental speculation has to be in connection with the Lord and the details given by the acharyas. Does that make sense? Then you can take and contemplate and put it together in different ways. But it's working, it gets the effect because it's still connected to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. But if it's just being done for fun, then it won't, and it's a waste of time. Right? So like that, you have to pick what's important. Right? Is that okay? I'm just saying is you just have to be careful of that, because that's just right on the edge. You can't go into so many technical details. You know, like, well, how big was the stick that Mother Yashoda was carrying and everything? You know, how fat, what kind of wood was it made out of? Or was it wood? Maybe it was bamboo, or, you know, maybe it was a rolling pin, you know, that just didn't... Sukadeva Goswami is just describing his ecstasy. He forgot the word rolling pin, so he just used the stick. But then there are rolling pins that are like a stick. You know, they're kind of flat in that. They're not two pieces, and they don't, you know, they do roll because you roll them, but they themselves don't roll on themselves. So then technically, would it be a rolling pin? You know, or would it just be a stick that's been kind of like carved, but it's been carved for a specific kind of purpose? But then, because it has a purpose, one would try to identify that purpose by calling, upgrading the stick, the nomenclature of the stick, to something that would indicate that particular kind of stick. But then I'm not sure if that would have, you know, but it does, is that really important to Krishna? You know, would he have been, would it have mattered what kind of stick that he would have gotten, you know? Does that make sense? But sometimes devotees, because they're really smart, they do this. You know what I'm saying? So if it's clearing doubt, in other words, if it clears doubts, establishes faith, then we, to that degree, we go into the metaphysics. Because that's what it's for. So clearing out the natural just surrender to Krishna process. right? Because always remember Krishna, this is what's going to allow us to remember, but always forget, don't forget Krishna, those are the things that take us away. So that's the metaphysics, is to cut that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anything else?
But also on the other side, you said that bhakti without the mantra is only simple. You know, it's not really devotion to service. So how do you explain that? I mean, sometimes, you know, we are not.
It's only sentiment. Bhakti is only means. It's specifically religion without philosophy. That's different from bhakti. Because religion means is you're following the natural duties that are connected with your particular material situation. Right? Your conditioned nature. Following the duties of your conditioned nature, that's dharma. Right? The ultimate dharma is the actual nature of the soul. So, therefore, in devotional service, those activities of dharma that are not opposed to the sanatana dharma of the soul, those are practiced. Right? Does that make sense? So, there's slight difference there. So, devotional service is being done under Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, then intelligence is being used to apply it. But the focus is more on karma. Right? Rather than on jnana. Right? And if the intelligence is being applied more, then you're applying, you're seeing the technicalities of what's functioning through the medium of karma. Right? And does that make sense? One is the actual technique, means your, how skillfully you apply the activity. And the other is what is actually going on in the activity in the mind, intelligence, and false ego. Right? And consciousness, like that. That's the difference between karma yoga and jnana yoga. Externally, all of them look the same. Because as we said before, even jnana yoga has to have a form. Right? The subtle has a form through which it's manifest. So, the karma yoga is the form of the jnana yoga. But because the emphasis is on the jnana, therefore it's called jnana yoga. Right? And when those two are done to please Krishna, right, then that's buddhi yoga. Right? So when karma and jnana are engaged in the Lord's service, that's buddhi yoga.
So all bhakti yoga?
Yes. Well, bhakti is when that devotion becomes prominent. You know? Because that's variable. Yeah, yes, of course. Buddha yoga is bhakti yoga. But where it just depends on, means which angle you're taking. It means if you're being more general for inspiration, then you take it that Buddha yoga is bhakti yoga because it's in pursuance of bhakti yoga. But it's called differently than bhakti yoga because it's the full manifestation of devotion may not have come. Right? So technically, prema is bhakti yoga, is bhakti.
Chanting 6 months could be called buddhi yoga, but if it's not done with full concentration, then it's not really.
No, but it's buddhi yoga, but it may not be. It hasn't developed devotion. The point is that the devotion is complete at prema, and less than prema, then there's still some mix. Right? So for us, pure unalloyed devotional service is the standard. But someone who's endeavoring for them, for that, because they're making that endeavor, they're getting the same result. So therefore it's classified in that way. Just like cutting sabzi is classified as cooking. But technically it's not. Right? If I cut up the vegetable, means, let's say we're going to cook, so you go in the kitchen and cut vegetables. But you can't say that you have completed cutting the vegetables, that anything's been cooked. Right? Right? And when it's on the fire, in the pot, it's cooking, but it's not cooked. You understand? So, the cooking is there. So, it just depends upon how you want to look at it. In other words, it's like this. If everybody's very enthusiastic, you don't make any distinguishing element between the cook and the people assisting. Because all are in there, they're all in the kitchen, they're all cooking for Krishna, it's a good mood. So there's no need, everybody's cooking. And you say, oh, who cooked lunch today? Oh, all of us cooked. Right? But now let us say the guy cutting the vegetables has an attitude. And the cook says, cut it like this. No, I don't like the cut. I want to cut it like that. Then at that point you have to point out, listen, I'm the cook. You're the helper. So you cut the vegetables the way I want it. You understand? So it's necessary that both viewpoints are there. Because otherwise, or you have the new enthusiastic guy who comes in, cut vegetable one day. Hey, I'm a great cook. I know everything about cooking, you know. No, you know how to cut vegetables, cooking something else. So whenever there's, whenever there's an illusion about one's position, then the actual standard that prema is bhakti is brought into play. But if the enthusiasm and the humility is there, and one's engaging in the devotional process, then from the very beginning, it's called devotional service. Right? So that's why these two viewpoints are there. They're both valid, they both have their place. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Another question I was saying at the beginning of the class is that ego is a combination of identity and God. As I understood from the religious teachings, that ego is a separate element, and it's created, actually the first element which is created after the mouth. If it's a separate element, would it be a mix, or do you mean like it is a practice of combination of mind and body?
Okay. And another report. It's its own element, but you see is what particular manifestation of the element is also connected with the mind. Sometimes the subtle body is described as mind, with three divisions, mind, intelligence, and ego. Because the point is that the ultimate effect is the value of the mind. You understand? That value then creates your identity. I value looking good, so I have an ego about I dress well. Right? I dress properly. I'm not like others. Right? But it's based on your value system. Does that make sense? Because your value system is going to create the body. It says from the mind, it creates the senses, which means it creates the body. The senses are connected with the intelligence. The body is connected with the false ego. See, there's another way of viewing it. It means you have this linear definition of the elements, which is how we use, because it's going from grossest to subtle. But those come in groups. The five gross elements are the external manifestation of the false ego, because they both come from ignorance. Right? The senses are connected with the intelligence. Right? So you see, you have the gross, And here, then you have the senses and the intelligence, then you have the mind in the middle. So the mind is the central feature of all of them. That's why you can just list the elements in the mind and everything else is taken care of. Because if you say you have the gross elements, you have the false ego. If you say of the senses, you have the intelligence. Like we say, body, mind, and words. Did we say body, mind, intelligence? No, we said words. Right? Because it's means the intelligence is there, but how do you know intelligence is functioning without words? The Prabhupada said, a fool, if he doesn't speak, no one will know. As soon as he speaks, it's obvious. Right? So you know your intelligence is being engaged if the words have, you know, proper meaning. Does that make sense? So, yeah. So that's another approach to it. As you see, is that the gross body is going to be, you know, in other words, from the mind, it'll get the senses, which will give the body that they go in. You have a certain kind of nose that goes in a certain kind of body, a certain kind of skin, a certain kind of ear. You know, say we hear, we get these kind of ears, you know. Animals have different kinds of ears. You know, the kind of eyes you want have like that, like the, what do you call it? There's some lizards, right? They have their eyes. And you see on their eyes, they're not like ours where they cross vision. They actually have a little tube in front. So it's like they're looking through something. And each one can look in two different directions. So one's looking here, one's looking up like that. And they look all over like this. And their brain somehow or another can function looking at two, you know, images, separate images at once. Right? So you want that kind of vision, then you have to have that kind of body. So we see mind, senses, gross body. But which means is mind, intelligence, false ego. That's just the gross manifestation. You understand? So it's in other words, there's never any contradiction. It's just the perspective that it's looking at it from. Right? Because if we're trying to bring out that the mind is a central feature, we'll bring that out. And so Aniruddha becomes the lord of the senses. Right? But because the senses actually are from intelligence, they come out of the mode of passion. And it's through intelligence that they actually technically function. Right? A sense distinguishes between things, hot, cold, or light and dark, or loud and soft, or pleasant and unpleasant, or, you know, salty and sweet. That's intelligence that you can tell the difference. But what you value, like the tongue, it goes, this is sweet. My value, I like sweet. Great. The tongue says, this is sweet. I don't like sweet. Oh, sweet. Sense, all it does is tell what's there. Right? Okay. You know? So then, from that, then you get the as I was going through there. So therefore, Prajumna is the lord of the senses. But you can also say Sankarshan, who is the false ego, is the lord of the senses, because the sense itself is manifest as an entity, right? It is a nose, you know, and so that is there, and that the element of the sense of nose is there. That's Sankarshan, because Prajumna and Aniruddha are actually subdivisions of Sankarshan, right? Sankarshan's first, he expands as Prajumna, and he expands as Aniruddha, right? That's the consciousness. So we're just talking about this mind intelligence false ego. So therefore, depending upon your consciousness, the consciousness is polluted, therefore the mind intelligence false ego are mundane. The consciousness is pure, the mind intelligence false ego are pure. That's why it says if you change the consciousness, you change everything else. Does that make sense? So therefore you can say all three of them are the lord of the senses. So depending upon your perspective, you will bring out that particular form. Right? It's not playing, it's just like that you had that cloth on your head. Can that be also used as a gumtra? Could it be used as a chutter? Could you lay it down on the floor and use it as a mat? Could you wipe the floor with it? Could you blow your nose on it? Could you roll it up with a ball and throw it at somebody? Right? So, but to do that, it takes on a different form. It's a different aspect. But it's the same cloth. So there's only Krishna. But depending on how you look at it, then you have all these different forms. So the only reason you can move it around is because it's the same person. It's the same entity. And those, all those energies are to please Vasudeva. Sandini, Vladini, and Sandhi potencies are to please Krishna. Depends. It means what we just mentioned there, as you mentioned, if you catch this, is that you didn't catch we're talking about energy and energetic. The energies are to please the energetic, right? So Vasudeva is the Lord who performs pastimes. His expansions are Shankarchan, Pajumna, and Aniruddha. So they work to please Him. You understand? So the mind intelligence of Paul's air to please Krishna. Just like the internal potency is, the three potencies are always trying to please Krishna. Does that make sense? Yes.
So, as you last question about the name, the apartments, and so on. Yesterday I was reading the Krishna book from the Uttama Research of Dhamma.
Can you speak a little louder?
The Uttama visits Vrindavan,
uh-huh,
showing the gopis. So then Prabhupada just talks about, you know, the absorption of the love of God, that is Krishna consciousness which we are trying to, you know, achieve or get in the moment. So when I read that, you know, and I came to Mount Rai this morning, you know, I thought, you're supposed to be Krishna conscious, but according to this reference, I'm supposed to think like the gopis, or, you know, being a Krishna in the form of love or what? How do we practically apply this in our present
condition? Just it means it's the absorption of the gopis. They're the perfection of completely absorbed. The body, mind, and words are absorbed to that degree. Right? That's what you're supposed to emulate. Does that make sense? In other words, when you say you should follow, do what that person does, means you have to do what they do that applies to you. Right? Does that make sense? So what applies to us is their full absorption and commitment to pleasing Krishna. Right? That's what you're getting from them. Not that, you know, you should start putting on kumkum and, you know, pick out a few nice saris and stuff like that. Okay. Say again.
Yoga letter.
Uh huh. Okay, regarding the yoga ladder, so would we say that same concept applies within devotional service, that you have the yoga ladder. Actually, it's the second part. The yoga ladder is only describing the elements of bhakti yoga. Those others are, how you say, misapplied or misunderstood devotional endeavor. Understand? Vedic literature is only describing the living entity's natural position in connection to Krishna. Right? And so, for the living entity to get to that stage means the body is absorbed in the Lord's service through activities, the intelligence becomes involved, and the senses become absorbed in the Lord's service. One's identity becomes absorbed in the Lord's service. One's mind becomes absorbed in the Lord's service. And until the point that one actually develops the devotion of the, the residence of the spiritual world. And then that, you've perfected that whole process. Right? But those who like to deal with the karma aspect without Krishna, then you get they perform the external activities, but for elevation, but not back to God, but just to the heavenly planets. So they're moving that direction, but they don't get all the way there. The jnanis follow that aspect of it, and so that gets them out of the material world, but only to the Brahman. Right? The yogis, that meditation would get them up to the super soul, but not to Bhagavan. Right? And so then the bhakti then will get one all the way to Krishna. Does that make sense? So it's not that it's two separate things. The yoga ladder is only describing the devotional process of karma, jnana, and jhana. Right? Your third chapter is karma. Your fourth chapter is jnana. Your fifth is the combination of those two, which is how they should be applied. That's called naishkarma. Then jnana yoga means your first six levels of the Patanjali yoga system is already accomplished through naishkarma. Because the first six are actually karma yoga. Right? But here the karma is being mixed with the jnana, so it makes it more efficient. So you don't need all the external physical elements to make it function. Right? Then when you get to the last two stages of the yoga, then that's you're meditating on Krishna. Does that make sense? So like that, then it works. It's not separate. Does that answer your question or not quite? Not quite. Within bhakti you have sakam and nishkam. Nishkam means jnana yoga. You can't have nishkam without jnana yoga. Sakam you can have without, it's just karma yoga. But you can have karma yoga where you have the proper understanding. It can be nishkarmya karma yoga. Like that. You understand? It's just a matter of where the emphasis is. It's just like, do you think all day about how to do your service more nicely, or do you think all day about technically what modes and different things and your attitudes and the egos and everything that are making up your motivation for the performance of your activity? Which of those two are prominent? The first, so that's called karma yoga. You know what I'm saying? And so if that is done to please Krishna, then it takes you to bhakti. Because the only intellectual element that you need is that it's not mine, it's Krishna's anyway. And if we're convinced of that, you don't necessarily have to break it down. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? But if you do naturally think of those things, then you can. You know, and then that will break it down for you. And then you see how it's not Krishna and how to do it nicer to Krishna. Right? Or you're so habituated to do it your service, you just think about Krishna all day. So that's Jnana Yoga. But you wouldn't say that these aren't Bhakti Yoga. It's just different stages. Does that make sense? But the Gita will describe them according to your, you know, your traditional Vedic externals of that. If you're going to take yoga on its own, what it would look like, or karma on its own, or jnana on its own. Because that's how people will know it and identify it. But as we mentioned, gross is always based on subtle. So if you have the subtle, it's already done. That's why at the end it says that the devotee, all the results of karma, jnana, or yoga is already attained by somebody that's bhakti. Because the externals, in other words, you don't have to do the externals of it to get the benefit of yogas, of yoga, or jnana, or karma. Does that make sense? Is that okay now? Is that better? I can't hear, unfortunately. Can someone say what she's saying?
She lost her 5 months ago, and she's not really inspired to do any service or chanting.
Not inspired to do any service or chanting. Well, okay. That's natural, because then the, you know, when a relationship is there, that becomes very much a part of the life, right? Grihastha life is there because one is inspired by material activities. So for those who perform, one is comfortable to do one's devotional activities. So that's why then the system of grihastha life is there, so that one can, those things that are distractions away from Krishna are then engaged in and ideally connected to Krishna directly. But if not, then at least they don't get in the way, then they'll, how you say, one will be relaxed and comfortable to perform devotional activities. But you also have to use your intelligence here. Is because one, is okay. Many angles. One is that you're a soul, not this body, right? So your daughter is a result of the body; has nothing to do with the soul, right? So if you're going to put the conditioned nature as more important than you, then you know, then that may not be the best position. Because the soul is the one that needs to chant, not the body. Right? We identify with the body, so we engage the body in the Lord's service. But the important thing is the service is there for the soul. It pleases Krishna. Right? Two, would your daughter be happy that you don't chant? Right? If you're a devotee, then people are born into devotees only are born into devotee families. Non-devotees do not take birth in devotee families. It just doesn't happen. Does that make sense? So, therefore, then if she's a devotee, would she be happy that you're not chanting? Yes or no? I see. Okay. I'm not going to get it. No, so then if you want to, if it means as a mother you would work to please your daughter, right? And so therefore why you wouldn't want to do the same thing now? Right? Does that make sense? Is that okay? In other words, with intelligence you have to cut through the make the attachment workable that you can actually do your service. Right? But you have to use intelligence. And association. Keep association with those who you like and are chanting. You know, so go sit with them when they're chanting. This daughter's gone. Daughter's, it happens. Right? Isn't it? Like, Let us take your grandmother. Is your grandmother still alive? No, but your grandmother was somebody's daughter. Right? So daughters die. It happens. Right? Normally it should happen after you, but sometimes it happens before. You know what I'm saying? So it goes on, so it's not abnormal. So it's just a matter of understanding that neither you nor the soul that is left is benefited by your not chanting. Right? So therefore chanting is good. Okay? Yes? No? Okay, I think we should answer it. It's getting late. Oh, you had a question. Yes.
I was just noticing in my life how I get attached very, very easily to anything and anybody, anywhere. Wondering why can't I use that ability to get attached to devotional service?
You can. It's just that you have to connect it. Means, okay, let us say you're attached to something. But that something, what are you going to do with it? You're going to use it in Krishna's service. Does that make sense? So in that way you connect it to devotional service. So in the beginning it may be indirect. But because it's always whatever you're attached to, you're connecting it back to Krishna. Then in that way your attachment gets connected to Krishna. Right? And then slowly, slowly, that will become more prominent than the material. Is that okay? Yeah? Yeah. Okay, try. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Chaitanya Tai Gaura.